Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming this evening. My name is Mary Evans from the Gender Institute, and I'm going to be chairing this panel discussion this evening on the subject of women and politics, change and continuity. We're very lucky to have four speakers with us this evening, all of whom have worked in this area and about this area and continue to work in this area for some time. I'm going to introduce them to you in the order in which they'll be speaking, and everybody is going to speak before about 10 to 15 minutes. After these speeches, we'll then have time for discussion, and we hope that you'll have questions or points that you want to make in relationship to what has been said. Before that, can I just make the standard housekeeping request that everybody please switches off their phones? Having said that, let me introduce then our speakers for this evening. The first speaker and the person who's going to speak first is Sarah Childs, who's Professor of Gender and Politics at the University of Bristol and author of a book called, most appropriately for our discussion, Sex, Gender and the Conservative Party, From Iron Lady to Kitten Heels. Sarah has also worked her time at the Houses of Parliament helping to put together a report for the Good Parliament Report, and I'm sure that she will have something to say about that this evening. The second speaker sitting next to Sarah is Sam Smethers, who is at the moment the Chief Executive of the Fawcett Society, a long-standing organisation which has championed various kinds of the rights of women over a number of years. The third speaker this evening is Mona Morgan Collins, who is an ex-student of the London School of Economics, obtained her PhD here, and now is working on postgraduate studies, I don't mean postgraduate, I mean postdoctoral, and my apologies, at the University of Pennsylvania. She's looking in particular at the ways in which women who had the vote for the first time did not necessarily vote in the same way as their husbands or other male relatives. And sitting next to me, I'm very happy to introduce Emma Crewe from SOAS, who has worked in development studies, in health inequality and health austerity, and is at the moment coordinating a research project on public engagement in Bangladesh and Ethiopia. So I'd like you all to welcome our speakers this evening, and then I'll pass over to Sarah. Thank you.
There's lots of very scary looking wires up here. I'm just going to check that this is going to work. Voila. Fantastic. Thank you very much for inviting me to be participating in this panel tonight. I'm going to give you some thoughts on what the political representation of women might mean, can mean, and how we might need to keep our eyes focused on the prize. Women should be represented in politics. I don't think this is just a feminist concern. I think it's a democratic concern. It's about political equality. And it is not yet universal. Nearly all the parliaments in the world have fewer women in them relative to the percentage of women in the population. Women and women's issues and women's interests must be represented in politics, despite all the problems, both theoretical and practical, that such statements beg, and I will go on to explain those later. And I speak tonight somewhat fearful in the UK of a backlash emerging against the case for the political presence of women, and I again will explain that a little bit later. We have to count women in politics. Even if it only tells us so much, it can't tell us everything, but it can tell us about numbers. We need to continue counting. Can I advocate here for you all visiting the Interparliamentary Union website, which has a wonderful World League table and documents the numbers of women going up and down. This table gives you the percentage of women and men elected to our House of Commons, the UK House of Commons at Westminster, since 1918. It's a rather wonderful and yet depressing chart, given that it still shows that women are so significantly underrepresented. There are 130 women missing from the current House of Commons. We are just about 30%, 191 women. Counting is important because it enables us to see whether there are increases, stagnation, or decline, and it reminds us that we cannot expect an onwards and upwards positive story. That is a fallacy. I wish that it was otherwise, but sometimes the numbers go down. It's also very important to recognise that looking at the overall numbers doesn't show us differences between parties, and asymmetry in party representation in the UK is another very important feature to emphasise. So we might be 30% overall, but Labour is currently over 42, 43% female, Conservative Party about 20, the Liberal Democrats don't have any, but maybe they'll return one in Richmond Park quite soon. I don't know about that. I don't even know who their candidate is, actually. Maybe Sam will know. What do we need to do? I was talking the other day in the launching of the British Council report about the SDGs, and I said, look, we've just got to talk about quotas. And people don't like quotas for the most part, but they do, and we're supposed to like evidence-based policymaking, and actually quotas do work. You might not like them, maybe you don't have to like them, but I want to suggest that we need them, because they address the lack of demand from our political parties, and they... Even if they can't address all of the problems, it's why I advocate a quota plus policy. The quota bit is the quota bit, and the plus bit is trying to address some of the other obstacles that limits women's access into politics. I wish there was a single solution to the underrepresentation of women. There isn't, but quotas go a bloody good way. Okay, that's worth saying quite that forcefully, I think. Two recommendations from my Good Parliament report. The first is to try and get this Parliament to legislate for the Parliament afterwards, because what they tell us is that they're doing things, they're addressing this issue, and then we wake up on general election day and we count the numbers of women and we find women underrepresented. Then the parties come back and tell us that we'll do something for the next Parliament, and we never really get very far. We don't get very far in the absence of quotas. So one of my suggestions here is that we legislate now for quotas to come into effect in 2025 if the parties do not do what they keep telling us they're going to do, which is to select and therefore elect more women. Section 106 of the Equality Act, I feel like I'm going to bore people to death going on about this at the moment. It's not, it is dull actually, but what this is, it's about candidate diversity data. It requires the political parties to provide this data so that we can keep an eye on what they're doing as they make their selections. The powers are there in law. They just haven't been what's called commenced, okay, which just means they could do it. The government could do it. The Minister for Equalities and Women could wake up tomorrow morning. I guess she might need to speak to the Leader of the House or something. But the powers are there, and I wish that they could hurry up and get that done. So let me talk a little bit about some of those concerns I have. People sometimes get worried increasingly about counting women's bodies because of the debates around women's bodies and around sex and gender and essentialism and some of the challenges from trans politics. So we can count women, and that will tell us something. We can look at the questions around which women are present. Because again, we want to ask those questions too. We recognise that women are heterogeneous, and therefore the women in our parliaments need to look like the women they represent too. We can be a little bit more radical, as in point three, and look at those multiple identities and recognise, as we do when we talk about feminist theory, that people have more than one, and therefore we can actually multiply those differences and those identities and get a much better sense of how diverse our parliaments are. But we might also want to add in something about quality control, if you like, preferable descriptive representatives. This is the work of Suzanne Dovey, and I think this is very important because it says we have to look at the quality of the representation that's going on. It's not just enough to get the descriptive tick. You have to have certain kind of good relations with those that you might be acting for. And in particular, Suzanne emphasises mutual relationships, particularly with dispossessed subgroups. So it's no good just talking to those who are well positioned. One of the other comments from the British Council debate the other day was about making sure that the women who are struggling the most are absolutely uppermost in our minds. And again, I think point four, joined with point three here, really gets us to look at the kind of questions about the difference that women in politics might make. It asks us to actually check what's going on. Now, I'm concerned, I said, also about a challenge in the UK, and I think what this hones in on, it has an increasing presence. It tells us that we're misplaced. It tells feminist academics that they're too concerned about women in politics, that the public don't really care. And actually, the women aren't good enough anyway, so the public don't care, and then you just want to put women who aren't very good in Parliament. But added on top of that is the accusation to do with class. And it goes something like this, and I don't think I'm parodying. Middle-class women are keeping out white working-class men. That's the kind of debate that we're hearing when we're in public and in Parliament, I think. This is work that I feel, and I've been doing with Rosie Campbell from Birkbeck. And we just have to remind people that actually all the working class are not male or white, and all women in Parliament are not middle class. Those concepts are much more complex than that. So we've got plenty of women, we've got millions of women in this country. We only need 300 who are qualified, credentialised and diverse. I think we can probably find them. I think their underrepresentation tells us not what's wrong with women, but tells us what's wrong with politics. And this class perspective, I think, really takes us into the terrain of substantive representation. So the wrong kinds of women are present, and that raises questions about the wrong kind of representation. So do they symbolise something that is exclusionary? Are they acting just in the interests of middle-class women? So that phrase of making a difference is one I used to like and now I don't, I'm afraid. I think it's problematic. I think it hides more than it reveals. It says the difference needs to be obvious, measurable, noticeable. And actually sometimes the difference women make in politics may be actually to change male behaviour, and therefore there will be no observable difference at that time. So when we look for differences, we say, do women think this and men think that? Do women do X and men do Y? We look at the difference and we say, oh look, women are good, it's worth having them in politics. But actually, we need to be much more complex. And that, I think, is where I have my real concern about this criticism, because I think it parodies the very complexities and the sophistication of gender theory and feminist theory in politics. It creates a straw woman that says getting women into Parliament will really make a difference and make a difference very quickly. And this is where I want to say that critical mass causes us too many problems. Critical mass suggests that when we get to a magic number, everything changes and some kind of feminist nirvana happens. Moss Kanter was very clear that there were three possible changes that follow on from changes in the composition of an institution. The first is the one that is the popular understanding of critical mass. And that's really problematic. Drewda Dahlerup in the 80s reminded us that politics isn't physics. There is no such thing as critical mass. It doesn't tell us which women are present. We must not confuse women's bodies with feminist minds or even gendered minds. Do not elide wanting to act for women and being able to. I think it's more important to identify critical actors and to give greater attention to gendered institutions. Critical actors are those who seek to and act for women. They're more motivated than others, and they have a lower threshold for action. And their acts are not dependent upon the percentage of women in parliaments. They might not even be women. They may have a positive effect and get others to act with them, but they might provoke a backlash. Now, if you read the empirical studies on the difference that women make, you can find contradictory evidence. And that will be used by critics against those who argue for women in politics. And I think we need to be careful. Some of that is about the way in which that literature is summarised in the secondary accounts. And sometimes it is, I think, just the way in which people have too high expectations of the difference women can make, because it presumes that women enter institutions that are favourably disposed to respond to the demands that those women are making. The relationship, most gender and politics scholars will always tell you, is contingent, mediated, and we need to recognise those. It's probabilistic, it is not guaranteed. We have to think about what we study. Do we just study the votes in Parliament, or do we study a gender setting? Do we study the content and the framing of debates? If you look at something like abortion in the UK, Labour men are very good at voting in a progressive way. But when it comes to the debate, it is Labour women arguing against Conservative men over women's right to bodily integrity. So I'm not dismissing Labour men's votes. They're very useful if you're in favour of more progressive legislation. But let's not forget that we don't just look at the end point. You can look at change over time. Johnny Lovandusky is quite clear that there's quite a lot of circumstantial evidence, right? We can't always prove what goes on in that black box of politics, but there's quite a lot of circumstantial evidence. And we can show quite well in global studies that there are occasions where big differences have been made. Let's think about gendered institutions. We need to look at the institutions that women in politics inhabit. They are not neutral spaces, they are highly masculinized. We need to think about the formal rules of the game, the informal norms, and how they favor particular understandings of the political and a certain kind of masculinity. The female politician pretender, think about that when you're thinking about Hillary. I'm drawing to a close. I want you to think about how we might want to change the ways in which our institutions are constituted. And this is the point at which my gender-sensitive secondment to the House of Commons turned into a report called The Good Parliament, because it's about diversity-sensitive parliaments. This I will leave up briefly for you to have a look at. This documents the diversity and sensitivities only in respect of the Equalities and Diversity Body, the new select committee that's been established. Can we say that the UK is unambiguously worthy of a green cross? The report makes a rather large number of recommendations. I'm afraid if you read it, it's quite dry, but it needs to be dry because politicians need to read it and implement it. Women in politics is a democratic right. I'm quite confident that given we live in a gendered society, that many of those women will want to change politics when they get there, but we can't presume it, and we have to think about the conditions under which they practice their politics. Thank you very much.
Okay, good evening, everybody. I should just commend to you Sarah's work, and I recommend that you do read The Good Parliament, because it's an absolutely it's a tour de force, really. It's a really thorough document recommending a whole raft of change that Parliament needs to adopt, and I hope very much that some of those recommendations at least will be taken forward. So we were asked to address two questions. One is the current situation of women in politics. I'll say a bit about that. And the other is the difference that the presence or absence of women makes. So I'm going to say a little bit about the national picture, but also talk about local government and devolution in particular, because we're doing some work on that for CIT at the moment. And I think it's important that when we think about politics, we don't just focus on Westminster, important though that is. So who are we talking about? We're talking about some, really powerful, impressive women in our politics today. And I think it's important to think about some of the positives. You know, we've got 29%, well, 30% of women, of MPs now who are women, really strong, powerful advocates for gender equality, for abortion, for all the causes that we champion and campaign for. And they are an important presence in our politics and in our democracy. And I think we can see the difference that their participation makes in terms of getting issues onto the agenda and getting them debated in Parliament and elsewhere, and getting them raised outside of Parliament as well, and having that sort of dialogue between the wider community and their wider constituency and what goes on in Parliament. I think what we also need to think about as well is what happens when you have structural changes that can perhaps put at risk the progress that we've seen. So we've had 21% in 2010, 29% elected in 2015. I think there is a tendency perhaps to just assume progress will continue. We will see another increase in women's representation at the next election because we've seen it in previous elections. And actually, I think there are some really significant reasons why that may not be the case in 2020 or whenever the next election comes. One of those reasons is actually the boundary review. We've been looking at that at Fawcett, and we're going to go down from 650 MPs to 600. Now, what that will mean is that there'll be more currently elected members fighting over fewer seats, plus it will be harder for those not yet in Parliament to get themselves selected. So it just brings in an additional structural change and barrier that is going to mean it's harder for women to both sustain their representation and to get into Parliament in the first place. But when you actually go beneath the total number and you look at who's at risk, you find that actually the majority of MPs at risk of losing their seats are Labour MPs, and we already heard from Sarah that actually that's where most of our women MPs can be found. And actually within that, 55% of those seats most at risk are held by Labour women at the moment. So all things being equal, we are likely to see a backward step in representation at the next election. Having said that, we're already challenging the party leaders. The Women in Equalities Select Committee is challenging the party leaders, and they're saying they're going to do something about it. And Jeremy Corbyn has said, we are going to commit ourselves to equal representation at the next election. Now, that's actually going to be a very challenging thing for him to deliver, but it shows that actually they're looking at it, they're focusing on it, and that means that some big changes are going to need to happen if we're going to achieve that 50-50 representation for Labour. I say that because the Boundary Commission has obviously got no remit on gender equality. It's not their job, they would say, to think about gender equality when they set the boundary changes. But it just demonstrates how easy it is for us to go backwards, just unintentionally, to see a backward step for women's representation. And when we know we've got half the population that's underrepresented already. I think the other thing to think about is what's happening in our public and political life in terms of the way in which we interact with our female representatives, the way they're treated in the media and social media, the kind of scrutiny they get, the kind of abuse that they receive on a daily basis. And what impact is that having on them, on the way they feel about the role that they play, their willingness to keep putting themselves forward to take it? Because it's really quite a tough environment out there, actually. And for those of you who use social media on a regular basis, I'm sure you'll be familiar with the kind of thing I'm talking about. And I think the tendency is to sort of find a way to try and ignore it or to brush it off. And actually, yes, up to a point that can work for day one or day two, maybe, but you can't actually sustain that level of abuse day after day and remain unaffected by it. So I think one of the challenges I think we face, and I want Fawcett to do a little bit of work on this in the next year, is to think about what the impact of this sort of misogynistic culture is having on women, both in terms of the ones who are already there in public life, but also the ones who might come forward, the ones who would otherwise consider themselves as potential future elected representatives. What impact is it having on them and their likelihood of standing and coming forward? So I think that is a really significant concern. One of the ways in which we have to address it, of course, is not only to think of it in terms of our wider culture, but think about what the parties themselves doing about misogyny within their own parties. How are they addressing it? How are they enforcing a policy position and a line which has said we're going to have zero tolerance on misogyny? That at the moment we're not seeing the resources behind the enforcement that needs to take place to discipline those who are guilty of it. And if you're going to create a very hostile culture, then fundamentally, how do you change that? And, you know, it isn't only about getting more women involved, because actually you've got to sustain and support them to be there, and you've got to change the culture that they're walking into. So we would support, and we always have strongly advocated quotas. You know, there's a great stat in Sarah's report, which is 80% of parliaments around the world that have got more than 30% women MPs have used some form of quota or positive measure. And that's absolutely true. They've proven beyond doubt that they work. But I think one of the challenges we face is, are we kind of papering over the cracks a little bit with quotas? Now, I don't want to say anything that undermines them in any way, but the truth is, if you don't make the underpinning changes, then actually you don't solve the problem. You are just hiding the problem. And what you see is it bubbling up, and we're seeing that in the Labour Party at the moment, if we're honest. We see that problem bubbling up because they haven't cracked the cultural problem that underpins it. So I just want to say a little bit about local government here, because this is an issue that's come through our local government commission that we're running at the moment. And I think it's really important that we focus on local government, because it's where the majority of local government employees are women. You know, services that local government runs impact heavily on women's lives. Women are disproportionately going to be users of those services. And yet we don't really think very much about the people who are elected to represent us at that level. And about 33% of local councillors are women, and that figure hasn't changed much in 10 years. 15% of council leaders are women. That has gone up in 10 years, but it's still pretty low. So we've been looking at just asking the question, does local government work for women, and running the commission, which is taking place, meetings around the country, and we're reporting in June next year. And some of the issues that have come up have been very interesting. We've been taking evidence on, the first one, is the session has been on getting into politics, getting selected as a councillor. And we had evidence from five different women, different parties, all giving evidence. And one of the things that struck me very powerfully about that session was they all really kind of openly said just what the problems were, what their experiences had been. They didn't hold anything back, and there was no positioning, there was no posturing at all between parties. It was a really open, honest discussion, all tweeted out live at the time. There was no Chatham House. They knew that it was going to be shared. And one of the issues that came up strongly was the issue of professionalisation of councillors. So you've got the additional responsibilities of being a lead member for Children's Services, as one of the participants was, Bridget Jones in Birmingham. And she asked the question, well, what happens if I want to go on maternity leave? And she was told, well, you'd have to leave up your job. We haven't got a policy for that. We don't know how to deal with that. And she was obviously quite shocked to hear that. But that is a sign, again, of a structure that isn't equipped to deal with women being in the workplace. Now, of course, a father might ask, well, what about my paternity leave, of course? It's not just an issue for women. But the point is, she's doing a job that's actually clearly legitimately asking the question, can I take maternity leave? And she's being told she'd have to give up that job. So the barrier for her in terms of participation is very real. She was also told, interestingly, across the chamber, that she was only promoted because she slept with her boss. That was another councillor saying that to her on the floor of the chamber in Birmingham. Now, that is a very hostile environment for women in local government, without any question, in one of our sort of main cities in the country. We also know, actually, that women are less likely to stay in local government and than men. So they might get in when they're young, they might get in when they're older, but actually the group with caring responsibilities are underrepresented. So we know, again, that's another barrier for them. I think one of the other things we want to do as well, thinking about this question about the difference and the presence of women makes, is interview leaders of local authorities, because I think one of the challenges with this question, and I wrestle with it myself, is, you know, do we have to justify, do we have to say the difference that women make? Do we ask the question, the difference that men make? And, you know, should we go and ask that, you know, what difference does it make for men being involved in our politics? And I think then we all think, well, we don't ask that question, we don't feel the need to justify it, but somehow we still have to. We have to play that game in order to kind of have that debate. So we will be interviewing women leaders to ask that question, the difference they feel that they've made as leaders of the local authorities. But I think it's a really double-edged question. And the third thing I just want to raise is really about the new structures of politics that we're creating, the new layer of local government that we're creating in devolution. Because I think it's really important that we take stock of where women are in that process. And at the moment, they're visibly nowhere. There's no gender balanced agenda, there's no diversity agenda within that process at all. The deals on devolution have been done literally men in suits going into the Treasury to talk to other men in suits to come out with a deal and put that to their local area. And we've got, you know, in the Northern Powerhouse, you know, seven combined authorities, all chaired by men. We've got individuals being selected to be mayoral candidates to lead those combined authorities. Three of the Labour candidates selected, three of them are men. There is no attempt at the moment to address gender balance in that process. And, you know, why does that matter? Well, it matters for all the reasons Sarah said, but it also matters because these combined authorities are going to be spending a lot of money, and they're going to have the power to make some very important decisions. And we need to make sure that women are represented in those decisions. So I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, we've just had a report from McKinsey on the gender pay gap, which gave us regional gender pay gap. So you could see, you know, the difference it would make if you close the gender pay gap in the North East, the North West and so on. So these combined authorities could make that a priority. They could make it a priority to tackle those issues. But I don't think they will unless we get women into the debate, unless we force that onto the agenda. Adult social care, another issue which is incredibly significant for women, both as carers and also as recipients of care and as care workers. You know, Manchester's going to have an agenda which is a combined health and social care agenda. Will they be prioritising, you know, investing in that care infrastructure, or will they be prioritising investing in roads and rail? And these are the kind of things that we have to get debated and discussed. And unless we bring it to their attention, it won't happen on its own. So the final thing I just wanted to say is this question about, you know, now that Theresa May's been elected, we've got women prime minister, you know, we might have Hillary in America, we might have, you know, we've got Nicola in Scotland. How significant is all of that? And at one level, it's incredibly significant, and at another level, it's not, if we're really honest. So, because what matters is, what do they deliver for women? What does it matter to women's lives on the ground? That's what I care about. That's what I think fundamentally matters. But I think seeing them there, seeing those photos, seeing those images does really matter, and we need to have that. We need to have those women leaders. So I'll leave you with that thought. Thank you.
So the last time I was here, I was commenting on the presidential elections 2016 in the U.S., and I realized I was the only non-American on the panel. And this time I'm going to be, you know, following on this discussion in Britain, and I am the only non-British speaker on the panel. So I will try to sort of draw some of the examples to some of the questions we're all speakers are supposed to address based on both my research, which has mainly been focused on suffrage, and also based on the U.S. situation, because somehow it gives me particular pleasure to comment on the U.S. politics from that, I suppose, European perspective. So I think one of the questions we want to ask is whether seeing Theresa May, seeing Hillary Clinton, is representing continuity or change. And I have taken some of these pictures from the suffrage time. So the first two cartoons are clearly anti-suffragist cartoons. You know, this girl, suffragist, is supposed to go back to her place, which is home. And I think the one cartoon that I like the most is the suffragist girl trying to steal the pants from the boy while he's sleeping. And then, of course, what we see today, for example, in the U.S. case, you know, it's Hillary who's now wearing the pants. So there is really something, using the historical language, where women are entering this, what was supposed to be or have been perceived as the male sphere or the public domain from which women were historically excluded. So on a first glance, it would seem that, you know, there is this massive reversal in the gender relations in politics as well, because now women have stolen the pants, in a sense. And some of the surveys, if you ask, particularly in the U.S., people tend to believe that we have achieved equality. People tend to believe that, why would I vote for Hillary just because she's a woman when I can just wait for my favorite candidate? Because we've already achieved the equality. And I think, of course, for example, Hillary does represent the change in gender relations in politics, but I think, as both of our speakers have addressed, and, you know, your perceptions, of course, suggest that that's not as simple. It has taken 100 years in the U.S. since suffrage, since we have a major female presidential nominee from a major party. And I think, so one of the things that I think I want to bring up from some of the quantitative research, the empirical research that has been conducted on these issues, is perhaps even trying to answer the question of why Hillary is not even more successful than she already is. And I think there is this, to what extent this is relevant for the politics discussion, it's for you to judge, but I really like the research that we do on ourselves, which is, you know, the evaluation of female teachers, and it consistently keeps coming up that there is a massive gender discrimination. And what I find even most funny about this is that regardless of how you actually perform in the exam, you're still more likely in the experimental setting to prefer male teachers. And I think there is a lot that this sort of research can inform the answers to the question why we see less women in politics, why it has taken 100 years almost in the U.S. To see Hillary taking the position where she is right now. There's also this other brand of research that on one hand tries to... So this... On a similar level, this research showing that in surveys, people tend to report, yes, I would vote for a female candidate if she was equally qualified. No one almost, in the surveys, it consistently keeps coming up, but no one would always, no one basically says, no, I wouldn't. But then when you do it in a perhaps more smart way, and that is that you try to measure people's implicit bias, that's where you find a striking difference. And that's something that I would urge you to actually do your home, because we all think that we're perfectly, you know, gender conscious, and then we take the test and we find out that that's not necessarily the case. So generally, the people who think that they're not discriminating at all are the ones who tend to discriminate the most. So what comes from this type of research is that they would try to measure, let's say, how well you can match female names to some of the powerful positions in politics, such as secretary, president, governor. And of course, people who tend to struggle to match the female names to those powerful positions are those that end up under experimental settings to vote less for women, given the same qualifications and policies. So there's also this literature, which I find personally very depressing, and that is what happens when my colleague, actually, Ole Falk and John Eric Rickniff, they work on a very fascinating, very rigorous work where they try to see what happens when you promote a female politician to an MP. So there is a promotion, suddenly the woman is taking this position in the parliament, and what happens there is following is that the probability that she will get divorced within a certain amount of years is far, far higher than for a man. So there's also something about women not only being less likely to be voted on because of some of these implicit biases, but also these women who do make it into the politics paying massive personal cost for doing that. I was talking to Melanie Hughes, and we were discussing about how best for a female politician to navigate this environment, and basically we concluded that the best thing for you is to have your husband dead. We could also think, in that respect, we could also think about the relationship between Bill and Hillary, and I think a lot has been written on this topic, but I think one of the things that hasn't been really brought up is that by having Hillary as the first female president, we don't need to, as a public, demote Bill, because he has already had his time. Right? So something that those two cartoons show from the suffrage era, that like, what happens if we give women the vote? We give them the vote, what happens to the men? Oh, reversal of the roles. It's the men who are going to be home with the kids doing the dishes. And so I think there is something to be said also about the fact that that's not the case for Hillary, although the situation is far more complex than that, but that's certainly something that I wanted to bring up. But does it matter? And I think Sarah has brilliantly brought in this literature on this descriptive and substantive representation. So what I want to do is something far more simplistic and kind of a bit more historical, and that is that we know that today women are more progressive. That's what's driving the gender voting gap in the U.S. Even in the UK, where the voting gap is not reversed, women tend to identify with some of these issues that we would call progressive or left-leaning, such as education, health, and so on and so forth. What we tend to not know is that this has been fairly consistent through time, even at the time of suffrage. Both of those two cartoons are at the same from the U.S. at the time of suffrage, and they tend to depict women promoting these progressive policies from suffrage, equal day, eight-hour labor force, health insurance, so on and so forth. The second one is a pamphlet that's trying to get women to vote on the matters that matter to them the most, which would be education, food, clothing, women's labor. So I want to separate two things. One thing is how women vote, and the other one, how their life experiences shape their preferences. And surprisingly, there is a lot of similarity between what we have seen 100 years ago and what we see still today in politics. And so there is something about that women have to say, clearly, substantively, and on average. The question is whether just having more women, regardless of their policies, is also something that we want to see. And I think what I want to mention here on this topic are those two research, recent researches, that I very much like, and that is I want to stress what we have already heard previously, and that is the role of the role model effect. The role models, seeing the women in the leadership position is very important, and I want to give you those two examples. The first one is a brilliant experiment. So what these researchers did in Switzerland is that they let female participants to conduct a talk or public speaking task, and then they had independent evaluators based on, you know, how well you think this talk was. And of course, the women who were seeing at the back of the room Angela Merkel or Hillary Clinton were performing better than the women who were giving the talk and looking at the back of the room and seeing Bill Clinton. So it is very important. I mean, to what extent this is externally valid is another thing, but it is an experimental evidence that seeing women in politics is very important for other women. A colleague of mine, Jack Blumenau, at the LSE just finished a PhD, and one of his key arguments was that actually in the UK House of Commons, if you appoint a woman a minister, more the engagement of other female MPs is much thorough. They tend to speak longer and be more engaging, and the relationship works the other way around as well, that the female minister is more likely to respond to the female MPs and their questions. So I want to, at the end, stress the importance of the role model effect, regardless of seeing women descriptively, regardless of perhaps us agreeing or disagreeing with their policies. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Finally, I'm a political anthropologist. You need to know that about me to begin with. And I study organizations. And my particular obsession is with parliaments, but also with civil society organisations. And I thought I'd do something a little bit unusual, which is make some comparisons between three extremely different countries, the UK, Bangladesh, and Ethiopia. I myself have studied politicians in the UK, and I manage a research project where colleagues of mine study politicians in Bangladesh and Ethiopia. So I'm going to say something and try not to repeat too much of what my colleagues have said about what it's like for women in politics and what difference their absence or presence makes. So I agree with Sarah, you've got to start with a bit of counting because it tells us quite a lot. And the presence of women is very different in the three places. although they've all had some increase. So starting with Bangladesh, in the last 20 years, the number of women politicians in the lower house has increased from 10% to 20%, so it's doubled. But this is in a context of a patriarchal culture in Bangladesh, which has been called by Anne-Marie Goertz, who's a very brilliant political scientist, as among the least negotiable in the world. So it's a difficult place for women to be in politics, and sometimes you experience quite serious violence. But how interesting, then, that we've got women running the two main parties since the 1980s. So the two main parties, the Awami League and the Bangladesh National Party, have been run by Sheikh Hasina and Khalid Azir, respectively, since the middle of the 1980s. And Sheikh Hasina has been prime minister since 2009. And yet, at the moment, we've only got two women ministers. And a lot of people would claim that Sheikh Hasina has not done a great deal to ensure women's fair representation in parliament. So I'll come back to why that is. In Ethiopia, we've had a massive increase in the last 20 years from 2% to 40% of women MPs in the lower house in Ethiopia. And yet we've only got, at the moment, one woman minister. But we do have 43% of the places on the standing committees being held by women. And finally, we've got the UK, which Sarah's already talked about. So I'll just reiterate that the House of Commons has 30% women. The House of Lords is even worse, 26% women. And we've got roughly 30% of the cabinet being occupied by women in cabinet positions. So, what's it like, then, in the UK Parliament, being a woman politician? Well, I thought it was, and I think women politicians thought it was gradually improving. Their number was increasing, even if it was a bit of a snail's pace. However, what's interesting is there's a big contrast between the two houses. And the experience for MPs and peers is exactly the opposite to what I expected. I thought going into the House of Lords, I'd find real misogyny, a really hostile environment for women, quite the opposite. Women do incredibly well in the House of Lords. They thrive in the very kind of courtly way that debates ensue in the chamber. It's not an ambitious place. The average age, I think, well, certainly when I last looked, was about 67. But it's also not the house where the real power is. So there's much, much less competition. So actually, of course, it makes sense that in some ways women outperform men, do very well in the House of Commons. In the House of Commons, again, completely to what I expected, I naively thought, well, surely these people are all young, shows how ageist I am, surely they're going to be egalitarian and progressive. But actually, it's an intensely hostile place a lot of the time for women MPs. And I think it's getting worse. And I think that's partly because you're very exposed, obviously, as an MP, and you're increasingly exposed. And the misogyny on Twitter and any kind of media, particularly where you can be anonymous, I wouldn't believe, except that I tracked it and followed it. It's really violent. It's quite extraordinary. So in some ways, I think it's getting worse, actually, in the House of Commons. There are three things, if I can borrow from my colleagues, because the people who are doing research in Ethiopia and Bangladesh are nationals of those countries. But if I can just borrow from their work, I just wanted to mention four things that I think women have to grapple with, which is a contrast to the experience of men in these parliaments. First of all, they do politics differently, but where women excel, if I take, for example, in the House of Commons, it's in the area of least visibility and least value. in a familiar way, because that's what often happens to women's work. And I'm particularly thinking of when politicians are in their constituency and they're dealing with very complex social problems with individuals in their surgeries or sometimes with groups. And I couldn't find many, maybe only one or two, women MPs who weren't really comfortable with that kind of work and really threw themselves into it. There were men I met who completely distanced themselves from that kind of work and delegated it entirely to their staff, which did, of course, leave them much freer to do much more visible public work like scrutiny or sitting on committees or climbing up the greasy pole and becoming ministers. The second way in which parliamentarians are different in all three countries, I think, is that women talked about a big difference between the men they saw as allies, not surprisingly, and the men who resist and block. So in all three parliaments, they talked about how they had both allies and critics. And the ways in which they spoke about some of their male critics talking about them is as if they almost contaminate politics. There's a little residue left of what Earl Ferris said 60 years ago, and I can't resist reading it out because it's quite amazing. He said, and this is when they were debating in the House of Lords whether or not women should come into the House of Lords, he said, "A man's judgment is generally more logical and less tempestuous than that of a woman. Why then should we encourage women to eat their way like acid into metal, into positions of trust and responsibility which previously men have held?" And it's not that long ago. It's only 60 years ago. Of course, no one would dare articulate such an extreme view, but there is some of that remaining. Thirdly, women feel undervalued. And in all three parliaments, women talked about the phenomena that if they're in a meeting where they're in the minority and they say something, it's frequently overlooked. Whereas if the same point is then repeated by a man, and particularly if it's a senior man, it gets taken up and called brilliant. And it's not only obviously in political institutions and that kind of pattern can be found. And finally, I think there's a really important point to be made about how women struggle with confidence. And again, this is not just in political domain. I know this from academia. And we had one particularly interesting focus group with Ethiopian women MPs who would only say this, by the way, once the male researchers had left the room. But once they had, we asked for the 12th time, "Tell us some more about what's the difference between being a woman MP and being a man MP." And they said, one of them said, and this is a fearsome woman. This woman was a chief whip. She fought for 15 years in the as a fighter, kicked out the military derg, and she said this. She said, "When a woman gets up to speak in Parliament, she is always fearful, thinking, 'Can I do this?' Whereas a man would never worry." I'm not sure that's necessarily proof that men do never worry in the Ethiopian Parliament, but how fascinating that that's how she saw it. So we heard prominent women in all three countries talk like this, and I think it's why Sarah Child's report is really, really important, because it's very important to change parliaments in order to make them more friendly places for women. But finally, I'm just going to say a word, if I have time, about what difference women make. I sort of agree with Sam that actually, we want women in Parliament anyway. But it is interesting to understand, perhaps, what difference they make and what contingent factors help them to progress their agendas, because it actually helps with Sarah's agenda, which is making Parliament more of a benign institution. So one of the claims in all three countries is that the women are too obedient. And one of the reasons that's given in Bangladesh is that they're appointed. So they have reserved seats, same sort of argument that you get said about some women MPs in Britain because they get in on quotas. And the claim is that they therefore just obey the whip or obey the leaders. Absolutely not true in Bangladesh. The women who were there on reserve seats actually took more actions, which pretty much everyone agrees were kind of feminist in some way or another, than the women who were elected. And the same was true in Pakistan. And in Pakistan, there's a similar pattern to Bangladesh, where what makes a difference to women being able to pursue feminist agendas, although that's obviously highly contested, and what that means will be up for debate. But the kinds of things that make a difference are not necessarily whether they've got in on quotas, but are these four things. First of all, whether they've got some kind of background in the women's movement. Secondly, whether they have political and legislative experience. Thirdly, whether they have knowledge of women's issues. And fourthly, whether they have links with civil society. And so when this is true, we can see examples of them achieving bills and policy changes and so forth. So I think we can ask these questions about whether or not women are bringing about change in terms of sort of output and policies and laws and things like that. But I don't think that's the only thing that's important about noticing whether women are having some kind of impact. I think it's really, really important to also understand the symbolic importance that Mona was talking about when you have women who have power. And I think one of the very important things that happen when you see women in very prominent positions is that you start to get some kind of recognition of women as leaders. And this is, of course, not the way women are normally stereotyped or seen. They're very often, it's kind of historically caricatured as witches, mothers, or whores. And I think one of the really important things that will happen, and I hope, because I'm an optimist, we'll see over the next few years, is we'll see women like even Theresa May and Angela Merkel, and maybe even Hillary Clinton, who show us women in a different role with a different kind of power. Not the kind of magical power of witches or reproductive power as mothers or sexual power as whores, but with political power. And I think that's really important, because if we can learn to love the idea of powerful women, then that will really change things for women in society from top to bottom.
Okay, thanks to all our speakers. And now is the point where we can invite you to ask your questions or make your points to contribute to the discussion. We have roving mics, and I think it'd be really helpful if when you ask your question or make your point, you could say if you want to address either of those to a particular speaker. We'll see how the questions go. We may at some point adopt the procedure of taking three questions at once. But first, let me just invite you to ask the panel questions, make any points that you want to. There are two hands up over there, so let's start over there. Three hands up. Right, okay. Let's start with three questions. Could we just hear all the questions, please, in that row, that group
Hello.
Of people?
Is this on?
Can't hear you.
You can't hear me?
Can now.
Okay, great. We're talking about the fact that Labour have the greatest share of female MPs, and that might be down to all women shortlists. But the last kind of few months and the last couple of years has shown that Labour Party members seem to be or have an unwillingness to elect women to leadership positions, whether that's leadership or vice leadership, or now the mayoral elections being fought next year are all going to be fought by men. Although we have a Tory female prime minister, and that's all well and good, those of us, I suppose, on the left worry, does the left have a problem with sexism, and does the Labour Party have a problem with women?
Okay, thank you. There were two more people sitting next to each other just there, please.
Hi, thank you so much for those amazing talks. So I wanted to pick up on points from Mona and Emma on how gendered conditioning affects different politicians' behaviours. And so I was wondering what your opinions were on, because you mentioned confidence and you also mentioned how women pass more progressive policies in general, and if you think that's because of women in general being conditioned to be more vulnerable and are more versed in emotional intelligence and practicing emotional intelligence, when those are quite scorned characteristics as a politician, but I think are really favourable and what we need essentially. So that logic that we explored earlier is a damaging logic, a rationality which is absence of empathy. And so yeah, I wondered what you thought of those points.
Okay, thank you. And there was somebody sitting next to you, I think. Yeah, thank you.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for those talks. They were really insightful. I've just recently been interested in the work of Kimberly Crenshaw, who is a US black feminist who coined the term intersectionality and talks about how power structures interact with minorities, particularly black women. And I'm just wondering how you feel that has a mark that has on UK politics.
Okay, thank you. I think two of those questions were addressed to the whole panel, so would you all like to address those two questions first, and then we'll come back to the specific questions.
Sure.
Thank you.
Is that on? Yes? Okay, cool. I'll start with the intersectionality question. That's precisely why I put up the feminism, bodies and identities slide, because I felt that to take intersectionality theory seriously when we're talking about individuals populating institutions, then we have to shift what it is that we're looking for when we count and decide whether an institution is or is not descriptively representative. And so it's not easy to do that when people have multiple identities. And so therefore, the logic of those four stages was to try to recognize different ways of counting and coming to a conclusion about a particular institution. And I think also to be reminded that behaviour is also very important, because if we're talking about structures and inequalities, then sometimes having a descriptive tick isn't sufficient anyway. And therefore, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. And in fact, Iris Marion Young, a theorist, social theorist, has a wonderful representation of a marble cake, where the colours of the cake sort of, as you sort of stir it, certain identities come to the fore at certain times. And I think that's quite a nice metaphor, but it's quite hard to translate that into measurable ways of judging Parliament. So that's, in effect, what I was trying to suggest, is that you could have multiple ways of judging the diversity of an institution. Does the Labour Party have a problem with women? I'm quite happy to say that, in fact, the women in the Labour Party says that Labour has a problem with women, and I'll take their word for it. But I do think all parties have problems with women. I think having a woman leader does not necessarily mean that you have systematically enabled women to participate throughout your party. I also think we need to remember the distinction between using quotas and quota plus strategies. And Labour, in my view, failed to sell that policy and to try and entrench the kind of other changes that you need. And therefore, some of the problem with all women shortlists that remains in the Labour Party is because people apologised for it and tried to hide it when they should actually have been very proud of it and tried to change the culture. In terms of all parties' problems with women, violence against women, I would just try and suggest that some of you, if you're interested, go and read the new report. The IPU currently are meeting in Geneva and have a new report on violence against women in politics, and I think they launched it yesterday or today. So if you're interested in parties and problems and that, the IPU is an amazing resource that, again, does global studies on women's experiences in politics.
Sam?
Just on the intersectionality point, I mean, this has come up very strongly through our local government work, actually, because we are looking at, you know, women with disabilities, women as carers, you know, black and Asian and minority ethnic women's representation. We're not just looking at women. And actually, there is no data on the basic kind of, you know, representation of candidates. So we can't at the moment tell, because there's no census data, there's nothing to tell us who the candidates are. We can do a head count of women and men elected as councillors, but because the Section 106 hasn't been implemented, No one's collecting that monitoring data, so you haven't got a baseline, you haven't got anywhere to start from. So we're going to be doing a big survey ourselves, and we're going to be collecting some data, which hopefully will at least be a contribution to trying to get a stronger sense of who, you know, these women councillors are in their diversity. But it's a major problem, we really need to sort it out. On the Labour Party, I mean, I think patently it's true that Labour does, and I think it's been a real, you know, eye-opener, you know, going to the Labour Party conference repeatedly over the last few years and going this year and seeing the kind of the debates that are being had and the, you know, the comments at the Reclaim the Internet meeting, for example. I was on a panel with Yvette Cooper, and there were women, Labour councillors, Labour members, from the floor talking about their experiences of the kind of treatment they've had. And it really was, you know, not the kind of thing that would promote the Labour Party well to anyone to get involved in politics. So I think Labour does have a problem with women. I think, you know, we need to tackle the issue of gender balance leadership. And if you look at what Sadiq Khan has done in London, he's appointed 4 deputy mayors who are women. You know, so that shows us that he's thinking about gender balance leadership in the round, and that's the kind of approach we need to take in other parts of government and Parliament as well.
Thank you.
Okay, so on the intersectionality, I think I want to bring up this research that, Melanie Hughes was arguing in her new research, and that is that she was looking at cross-national evidence, and what she finds is that it's actually the more heterogeneous societies that are less likely to adopt quotas, particularly prior to the 1990s. And what she's saying is that some of these majority men are using the single-axis politics to make sure that they keep the power. So, for example, you could think about sort of, I think the example that's probably most illustratory for me right now is on Switzerland, where men divide power very early on. It's a country that democratizes far earlier than the rest of Europe, based on selected identities, based on selected groups, and they're very unwilling to change this for a very long time. So female suffrage happens at the end compared to the rest of Europe. So there is something about the majority men using the single-axis politics to perpetuate their power, and unwillingness to, once they divided the power, unwillingness to keep dividing to some of these other groups that that claim piece of the power at that particular time. On the first question, I think I agree with what has already been said in terms of labor in the UK and the approach to women. What I want to mention is, though, 1928 in the UK, working class women and young women get enfranchised. And you would think that the vote goes to the labor. And actually what we find is that it's the liberals that they're getting these votes. So that to me suggests, and someone has already suggested it to me, that, you know, this relationship between women and labor in the UK particularly is very problematic. So if women do have these policies, then they just go for liberals rather than, at least that has been, you know, at least in the past. There has been something about, although labor was very aware of this at the time of suffrage, so they were trying to attract women, at least at that point they failed. But I agree that I think all parties have problems. So it's very difficult to pinpoint the details on that.
Yeah, thank you. Gosh, we're in violent agreement.
No.
How boring of us. but politically useful. I think I agree that there are problems with all parties. I mean, there are feminists within the Conservative Party who find it an extremely difficult place to argue their feminist issues because it's not part of the language that's currency, in a way, within that party. On the other hand, within the Labour Party, but also within the ruling parties in both Ethiopia and Bangladesh, which are kind of a bit left of centre, those are exactly the parties where I hear women MPs talking about how they're accused of diluting the cause. And I think this goes back to a very, very long-standing uneasiness between sort of Marxism and feminism, really. Very unhappy, kind of awkward marriage because of this perception that each side is kind of diluting. And because disagreement, you know, does undermine a nice, simple political agenda. But I connect that with this business about intersectionality, because I don't, we can't politically ignore intersectionality. I mean, so you cannot assume that a woman, for example, can represent the interests of half the population or even know what they are, because they've got all these multiple identities. So it is a very heterogeneous group of women who need to be in parliaments. And just finally on this question of whether women are more progressive and in what way they are, or let's say that they are, then why are they? And I think it's really, really important not to kind of romanticise women. I work in international development agencies where I see a lot of this kind of idea that if you give women loans and if you give women responsibilities and all this kind of thing, they are much more responsible, they're much more altruistic. Well, first of all, they just get a lot more unpaid work to do, which isn't very satisfactory. But the other thing is, I just don't believe that. I think women can be very progressive, partly because, of course, they have an intimate experience of being on the receiving end of power inequality. So partly it's their experience that makes them very alert to the need for progressive policies. But also we're socialised so that it's really hard to look as if we're not being altruistic. So there's a very strong cultural taboo on women, I think, to be sort of self-interested. So there's all kinds of cultural reasons, I think, as well for that.
Okay, can we take some more questions, please? One, two, three, four. I'm going for four now, okay? So if you could make them fairly brief so everybody has a chance to ask something. Can we start over there, please, and then come back
Thank
here.
You very much. So my question is, like, we're talking, or you've been talking about women in politics sort of in isolation and away from the electorate. And perhaps, like, so I'm originally from Latvia, and perhaps the experience that we've had is even if you put more women on the ballot papers, actually what women voters tend to do is not go for other women. And perhaps there is some role for the seeing the women role models and seeing strong women in power positions. But do you think there's, like, perhaps, like, an extension to this of what we can actually do in society to not just to, on the one hand, introduce the quotas, but on the other hand, also promote women voting for women?
Okay, thank you. Your question here, please.
Hello. I have a question for Dr. Mona. Hello. Because before this talk, I looked to search you on the internet and found that you used to have a project about all the CVs of politicians. And I wonder that, have you found any shared values of the women in leadership right now? For example, Taiwan's president Tsai Ing-wen, and on German, the prime minister, Merkel, and UK's prime minister, Theresa May. Do you find any shared values between them? And if there are, do you think it is a global social change now? And do you think that what happens in these countries that women emerge in politics, it is a coincidence or it is a global social change? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Now there are two at the back, please.
Thank you very much. I would like to raise a question for all of you about the correlation or articulation between women's presence in parliaments and positions of power and the nature of the political and electoral systems, if there are differences between presidential systems and parliamentarian systems and different parliamentarian systems, and also political cultures. I think this creates an heterogeneity that needs to be taken into account.
Okay, thank you. There's somebody else, please.
Thank you. My question is in response to some information that Dr. Morgan Collins shared about the role model effect. And I was wondering if research has been done to see if men respond in similar ways, performing better when there are men as an example, or if there has been research done in looking at different intersectionalities, so for race or anything like that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's start the other way around. So, Emma,
yeah,
can
good,
you deal with
you.
Those four questions?
Can I just pick the ones that
yeah,
I find
of course
easy?
You can.
I've learnt from politicians.
Sure.
One of the, I think it's really interesting actually understanding a lot more about what's going on with electorates. And I was interested in what you were saying about, the very subtle biases, because there's other research done by Phil Cowley and Rosie Campbell, isn't that? That gives the impression that gender in this country anyway makes no difference at all. But now you're making me think, hang on, these kinds of things are so hard to find out. So the first thing you're making me think is, that we just need to know much more about this. It's a really complex question and we need to find out more. On the business of stimulating debate within electorates, I think this is really urgent. And not just for the reason that you say, but I'm getting very interested in interacting with my own MP, but also, thinking about, how could we get citizens to get into conversations with their representatives at all levels and ask them, what exactly do you mean by you're going to represent our interests? Whose interests? They're all conflicting and diverging, and there are multiple, and they change all the time. So how do you even find out about them? And how are you going to represent them? And by the way, I'd like to ask you this question every year if you get in. And, so I think that's a really important question. And I just wanted to say one thing about culture, and then I'm going to leave the other questions, if I may, to others. I think you're absolutely right. It's really important to understand about political culture. But I think people often talk about political culture as if it's divorced from power within political institutions. And I think they're, not that I'm saying you said that, but I think they're intimately linked. Things can look. PMQs interest me because, of course, lots of us find PMQs, Prime Minister's Question Time, sort of culturally really uncomfortable, very aggressive, and all this kind of thing. But actually, I think what's really hard sometimes about PMQs is that very often politicians aren't talking really to the other side. They're trying to kind of rally a lot of loyalty from behind them within their own party, and they're talking to the media. So I think you're right. We have to understand exactly what's going on in these complex cultural stroke political situations before we think about how we can change them.
So we're kind of running out of time, so I'm going to do a selection, but if you want to approach me afterwards, I'll be here, so please do ask. So the one comment I want to make about is the voter bias, women voting women. There's actually mixed for women on these ballots. There's mixed evidence on that. So, for example, in what happens in Argentina, and there's, again, quasi-experimental evidence, which seems to be very well thorough, that we are fairly certain that the moment you give the electorate chance to vote out women through these preferential votes, that's what they do. At the same time, evidence from Spain, again very strong, is actually the opposite happens. The moment you give them more votes, then they're like, oh, I'm going to vote for men, and then I'm going to vote for the women. And that's mostly driven by women. So there is mixed evidence, and it probably depends on a number of different factors on how to explain that. In terms of the one question we've forgotten, and I really want to come back to it, is the confidence and the role in politics. And I think there is this one research Fox and Lawless has that in one of the top journals in political science, well-cited research, saying that even if you hold constant the qualifications, women are less likely to put forward themselves into political positions. And the crucial thing is that they're equally qualified, right? So it's the impression that they give. There's also this research on what we call this Jill and Jack effect, where actually female members of Congress are far more active, and the reason in Congress, in terms of bill sponsorship and some of these other things that we could measure, and one of the reasons has been proposed in the literature is because it's far harder for them to get elected. So you're actually getting the best women elected, therefore you see the difference on the success. So that, all of this, I think there's a lot to talk about. Presidential parliamentarism, just a quick note. Of course this matters. And I think the first thing that comes to my mind is I have heard a number of times attributing the difference between perhaps the female leadership in the UK versus the US to precisely this, that in the UK you have the party, so the woman needs to get through the party and then gets the prime minister, whereas that's not the case in the US. But I think we would find far more than just this. I think it does matter from the global perspective as well.
On the question about women vote for women, about 10 years ago I did some work at the Equal Opportunities Commission looking at what difference it made having women candidates. And one of the things we were looking at is, it was a bit more subtle than that. And it was questions like, well, are you more likely to identify with a party? Are you more likely to feel that it represents people like you? So it was those kinds of things which were strengthened by having women on the ballot paper. And men weren't deterred, so it encouraged women, but it didn't put men off. So that was an interesting kind of dynamic. But I think what drives people to vote is it's not going to be the gender of the candidate, really. It's going to be, you know, the big things that are the drivers we know in terms of can you trust them on the economy, welfare, immigration, NHS, those sorts of things, really. On the cultural question and structures, I just wanted to talk about, you know, we've created two other institutions in the UK. We've got the Scottish Parliament and we've got the Welsh Assembly. And if you go to those two institutions, you get a very different feel. When you're in the chamber and listening and watching debates, when you see them in action, it's a very, very different place. And in 2003, we had 50-50 representation in Wales. And, you know, all the evidence showed that, you know, the women there were raising, you know, childcare, domestic violence, much, much more than was being raised before in the Westminster Parliament. You know, they were making a difference in terms of what was being discussed on the floor of the House. And the way the business is conducted is very different if you compare to the, you know, very sort of bare pit atmosphere of certainly PMQs and other debates in Westminster. And then the only other thing about political systems is, you know, PR tends to favour women's representation, you know, ensure you get better women's representation. So women tend to do better out of that than first past the post. So we've got a few things in our system which are kind of, again, structural barriers to that sort of progress.
Okay, I won't sort of repeat what other things that people have said. I think on the confidence issue, I always like to think of recruitment being an active verb. So the real thing about confidence that worries me is that we end up blaming women for lacking something, whereas actually what we should be doing is problematising parties for not going out and recruiting women. Because if women are less likely to put themselves forward, then there's a responsibility on parties to go out and find them and actively recruit them. So I'm more than happy. I mean, I think the Lawless and Fox is fantastic research. What is interesting for me is how we translate that into transforming party behaviours. How we link women in politics. I was asked by a journalist this week to comment on Momentum Kids, and what he wanted me basically to say was that this was a terrible idea because leftist women were going to indoctrinate their children with really dodgy leftist views. And I sort of said, look, if you want people with caring responsibility to participate in politics, you're probably going to need to create environments when they can bring those they have to care for together. And, you know, unless you show me evidence of indoctrination, I'm just going to think that this is a group of mums wanting to have a place where they can talk about politics, where their kids can play. Now, I may be too naive about the terrible things that might happen to these children, but I think they're probably going to be okay. And I think that's really what we need to do. We need to transform the idea of where politics takes place, who the actors in politics are, and what it is that constitute politics. And it's so difficult, there's so many wonderful questions, and they're all, the answers have to be so nuanced, and that's why it makes it so hard to say and answer that question about what difference women make, because there's always constraining factors. I can tell you that there are countries that have the same socioeconomic histories and have hugely different percentages of women, or countries that have the same percentage of women but are different on every other kind of political structure, economic, cultural characteristic. So something, there's not just one answer. So there might be difficulties in presidential systems, and yet if we look at Latin America, we see different kinds of recruitment and families and dynasties, or we might look other places. So it, unfortunately, it makes it very unsatisfactory to have a very robust, simple answer to what determines the numbers of women in politics and then what those women do once they're there. And that, unfortunately, I think, makes it harder for us to be compelling. But I'm really scared of that straw woman which says, look, just get more women in and it'll all be all right. None of us want to say that. And somehow we have to satisfy people asking us. But the differences and the nuances and the complications are there, and we have to acknowledge them, so there is no simple answer. Sorry.
Okay. We've got time for just one more quick question. Really quick, please.
Okay, so building on that, this idea that just measuring women isn't good enough, I would have been interested, for example, if we have a sense of how many politicians self-identify as feminists. And, you know, there are interesting other ways in which you could measure. The Bechdel test, for example, has a whole set of things that measures not just whether they're women in a play or film, rather, but how they relate to others. And then linked to that a bit, in your report about good governance, how do we make sure that 5 or 10 years from now that those recommendations have moved things forwards? We've got a lot of examples, Corsten Report, for example, where fantastic recommendations are made. How, as civil society, can we ensure that those recommendations 5, 10 years down the line are positive? And I guess if there's time, one question would be, if each of you had one really good indicator that you thought was what we should be measuring, what would that be?
Perhaps we could just take that part of the... since we are running out of time, perhaps very quickly, and this time in this order from Emma, if you could answer that last question that's been raised. What is the crucial indicator of change?
I rather like this idea that we have a different rating of very powerful women, because I think it's interesting that Hillary Clinton is disliked to the extent she is. So if you've got a very powerful, tough woman like that, and her popularity rating goes up, then I think that's a good indicator.
Okay.
It's a fantastic question. I'm going to go home horrible and think question. About it. No, because I'm just going to say that there's probably not one best indicator. There's going to be 100,000 different indicators, and we want to make a progress on all.
I think we need a real power analysis, so I think we need to be measuring where women are in those really powerful positions. And at the moment, we do too much sort of counting of how many heads there are, and actually not enough of a sort of real scrutiny of where the power and decision making is. And we really need that diversity data, so we really need to know who our candidates are in all their diversity.
My judgment would be that politics is something women ordinarily do.
Fantastic. I think that's where we might start the next. If we can replay this and have a panel again, that would be great. Since we can't and we have to stop at this point, can I thank you all for your questions, for being here this evening, and most importantly, our panel. Thank you all very much.